Genesis 12:1-12:9, The Promise to Abraham. The 14th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 27, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, we're going to talk about Abraham tonight, the promise of Abraham, the blessing of Abraham, the covenant that God made with Abraham. We'll look at the first 3 to 9 verses of chapter 12 primarily. However, really there's no way to look at Abraham without going all over the place. And there's a vast amount of material. I can't get it organized, so we will be disorganized tonight. I want to concentrate to start with on the first 3 verses of chapter 12. Before we get there, though, I think in order to understand, to get the full impact of what's going on here, it's really helpful to see what we're looking at in this event in the context of Genesis, first of all, in the context of the book of Genesis, on the one hand, and in the context of all of biblical history, on the other hand, as well. Because with all those people running around and doing whatever those people were doing back then, the account that we have in Genesis is an account through the first, say, 11 chapters of basically two lines of people. The godly line, the people who walked with God, and then the other group of people who didn't walk with God. And it ended with the world getting so bad that God, how's he put it, repented that he had made it and destroyed the whole thing except for saving Noah and a few members of his household. And that's one of the last things that's happened, other than some genealogical details in between that are still carrying on this idea that mankind always splits into two, the people who walk with God and the people who don't. That's kind of the context here. And then all of a sudden we begin to focus our lens in really tight on this one particular individual, Abraham, which is very striking when you think about that. That out of all of human history, there's this one man way back in ancient times, thousands of years ago, that all of a sudden the biblical record is really interested in. And we need to keep that in mind. This is not just some righteous dude somewhere who is a good example for us to look at. He's more significant than that. This is a bigger deal than just somebody who did right. Job was somebody who was good. Enoch was somebody who was good. But this is Abraham. And it's different. And in looking at the account, we have to keep in mind what's so different about this. Okay, verse 31 of chapter 11 reads, "And Terah took Abram his son." He starts off being Abram. Later in his life, God, in one of his revelations with him, changes his name to Abraham, but his given name was Abram. "And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." Going into chapter 12. "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." We have a man who lived in Ur of the Chaldees, which was basically in modern-day Iraq at the end of the at the delta of the or near the delta of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. It was probably the dominant city-state in Babylonia in the Mesopotamian area at that time, in Chaldea is what they called it at the time. And that culture would have been a thoroughly polytheistic culture. Polytheism is basically the view that polytheism is a very intelligible view, actually, I think. And in fact, I think, going back to what we were commenting on in the last session, or in the session before the teaching here, that's probably going to be what, in these last days, becomes the dominant philosophy of people, is a return back to a kind of polytheism. It'll be a hip and groovy modern version of it, but it will nonetheless be a form of polytheism. Polytheism basically sees reality is divided into two parts. There's the part down here that we see, that we experience. We see causal relationships, cause and effect between things happening down here in this world. But not everything that happens in our life is ultimately explainable in terms of things that we can see. At least it would appear that not everything is explainable. If you want, we can discuss that further, but let me just leave it at that for now. So, how do we explain what happens down here? Well, there's a whole other realm. There's a whole other dimension to reality, an invisible realm, an invisible dimension. And the relationship between these two dimensions is that what happens up here in the invisible realm ultimately controls, dictates, guides what happens down here in the material realm. And, to a certain extent, what happens down here can affect what's going on up here as well. So there's a causal relationship between the two realms. This realm, in effect, mirrors what's happening up here in this realm. Well, what's up there? You know, what is it like up there? What does it work up there in that realm? Well, there are forces, there are realities at work that enter into and guide the course of the world and the course of our lives. We think in these terms. We don't think that we're being polytheists, but we're not unfamiliar with thinking in these terms. You know, the phrase "love makes the world go round," or we talk about justice doing this or truth doing this, or we just think that we're speaking in terms of abstractions, and we probably are, but it's a small step to take that abstraction and give it reality itself, turn it into something that has a life of its own, if you will, something that has its own, its autonomous existence in its own right. Well, that's, in effect, what polytheism does, is it takes those things that we are inclined to think of as just abstractions, and it sees them as having a kind of a life and a reality of their own in this, often this invisible realm somewhere. Well, once we've decided that there are these realities, these abstract, universal, independent realities out there that are not visible to us, then the question becomes, what's the nature of those things? What are they like? One answer could be, well, they just run by regular laws. They are law-driven. They just do what they have to do, much like the way we think of the physical universe. The physical universe just operates the way it has to operate according to the natural laws. Well, one way would be to think of there being spiritual laws up here, and these spiritual laws ultimately govern what happens down here in this life. The problem is, that doesn't seem to really explain our existence. Because our existence seems ultimately more mysterious and more inexplicable than that. It's really hard to figure out how the course of my life is going to go. If I could figure out spiritual laws, and they were like natural laws, then I ought to be able to predict how my life is going to go. But if these are not like natural laws, then that would explain why I can't figure my life out. So how do we understand these invisible forces up here? Well, they're kind of like people. They're unpredictable, they're complex, they're willful, And they're ultimately not reducible to just simple mechanical laws. So we anthropomorphize them. They are men and women who get angry, who get jealous, who get envious, who get sad, and all that kind of stuff. And the way they treat me, in other words, the way this reality impinges on my life and my reality, sure looks like the way people down here that I can see impinge upon my reality. How can I salvage my life in any way? Well, I need to do whatever I can to be on their good side, so that they will go to work for me rather than against me, so that those forces, those realities up there will seek to act favorably toward me rather than unfavorably. The point I'm making is, we sort of have a cartoon image of polytheism, where we think that they believed that Zeus actually lived up on Mount Olympus and was in a cave somewhere, and if we could just find the cave, there he would be. But I really don't think that they were that silly. Yeah, they spoke metaphorically of him living on Mount Olympus, and they did think that these gods could personify themselves in human form. So the Egyptians, for example, believed that the pharaoh was Amun-Re, the god personified in the form of the pharaoh. That's true, but that's not all he was. He was also big enough, powerful enough, significant enough to be virtually omnipresent and ruling the universe anywhere and everywhere that Amun-Re had to rule the universe. He wasn't localized in the pharaoh. He was, but he was also transcended the pharaoh. He was up here as a spiritual being, that it was operative everywhere, all the time. Well, when you look at it that way, when you get rid of the cartoon view, this is not a crazy view of reality. It's not an implausible view of reality. It's not true. But the reason you and I know it's not true is because the God who really is the ruler of all things has broken into our reality and revealed himself and told us what's going on. But had he not done that, wouldn't this be what we believe? I think so. That's what Abraham believes. The text doesn't say that, but scholars are pretty much in agreement. I think there's commonly held belief that Abraham started off a polytheist. One is, he's coming from Ur of Chaldees, and we know that Ur was a polytheistic culture, thoroughly. So, in all likelihood, that alone would tell us that that's probably where he's starting from. I don't know the details on this, but the other thing scholars point to are the meanings of the names of his family members and of his family members, that they seem to be typically names that are honoring the gods of the Chaldeans. Okay, so here we have this polytheist who in principle could understand, could find it plausible that one of the gods up there in this invisible realm would manifest himself or herself to you and say whatever they had to say at any particular time that they wanted to. To this polytheist comes the one true living God, the creator God, the transcendent God, the author of all being. He appears to Abraham and he says, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation," and so on. Now, I want to come back to this, but I'm just setting up a question that I want to raise and talk about a little bit later, and that is, if you're your average polytheist living in Chaldea at this time, and a god appears to you and says, "I'm going to show you a land that I want you to go to, go there," would you do it? One. And two, if you would, why? Why would you do that? What's going on in Abraham's thoughts? What's motivating him? What is he thinking? What is his perspective here that he would just up and obey this God, just to obey this God. From his point of view, he might be mischievous as well as benevolent, for all he knows. Gods are very unpredictable. There's no telling what they might be up to and what they might be trying to accomplish. So why would he do this? We'll come back to that. What did God say to him? Go forth from your country, that is, leave Ur, and from your relatives and from your father's house, to the land which I will show you. The text, the reason I read chapter 11 is that that text makes it relatively clear, and later in the Genesis it makes it clear that he did it in two stages. First, he moved up the river to Haran, where his family had originally actually come from before they had moved to Ur. He moved back to Haran with his family. He waited there, lived there until his father died. And then upon the death of his father, he then traveled on to Canaan in obedience to this this covenant that God was making with him. So go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And that's the land of Canaan. And if you will do so, and assuming you do so, and one thing I want to make clear at this point, everything that God says to Abraham, contrary to what many Bible teachers might tell you, everything that God says to him throughout this section is conditional. There's a condition attached to it. It really is of the form, if you do this, then I will do this. If you will do this, then I will do this. If you will do this, then I will do this. The Bible also treats it, at the same time that it understands it to be conditional, it also treats it as non-contingent. And what I mean by that is, which strikes us as odd, I mean, those don't seem to go together at first blush. What I mean by non-contingent is, this coming about, this becoming a reality in Abraham's life, is not contingent on Abraham's own... it's not contingent on Abraham autonomously doing what God has asked him to do. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't happen, as opposed to necessary, the opposite of necessary. Yeah, it's not dependent upon Abraham's autonomous choice, and I'm emphasizing the word autonomous here. Because the only way you can understand how can something be both conditional and non-contingent at the same time is if somehow God is committed to working within the life and mind and heart of Abraham himself to make sure that Abraham meets the conditions of the covenant. There's no other way to put it together, I would argue. That's the most plausible way to understand this. The text does not get into the intricacies of that. It doesn't get into the metaphysics of that. It doesn't give you a theory of how God in his sovereignty relates to the freedom of the human will. It just doesn't explore that. But it gives you a piece of datum that's really pretty important. The text treats the covenant as a conditional covenant. Let me just give you an example of my evidence for that. If you look at chapter 22... This is that one of the last major things that happens in Abraham's life. It's where he's asked by God to sacrifice his son Isaac. And Abraham is willing to do so. He takes him up on the mountain. He prepares to kill him, to offer him as a burnt offering to God. God stops his hand, says, "Just kidding, there's a ram over there, why don't you use that?" In response to that, here's what God says, and I think this is just really highly significant, the way he puts this. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your descendants, your seed, as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." Now the thing that's really significant about that, he promises, with the exception of one phrase in that, everything else that he says he's going to do because he has obeyed his voice was promised him in the passage I read earlier in chapter 12. Uh, or or the next promise he makes in two chapters later. By the time this happens, everything that he's promising here has already been promised to Abraham. He said, here's what I'm going to do for you. And then finally, years later, I mean, we're talking 20, 30, 35, 40 years later, I didn't count, but quite a while later, God, in a sense, puts Abraham to the test. Abraham passes the test, and God says explicitly, because you have passed the test, because you have obeyed by my voice, I would interpret it to mean, because you have demonstrated yourself to be someone who takes me seriously, who believes me, who honors me, who wants to obey me and serve me, because you are that kind of person, I'm going to give you what I promised you I was going to give you. And yet, elsewhere, and I don't have ready at mind a particular piece of evidence at this point, but I would argue, for example, the New Testament authors, at the same time, treat the promise to Abraham in chapter 12 as non-contingent. This is not iffy. It's not if it happens to be the case that Abraham gets around to doing what he's supposed to do. Abraham will get around to doing what he's supposed to do. How can it be otherwise? Because God has promised. God has spoken. God has declared. Well, here's a piece of evidence right here from Genesis. I think that's the significance of, this is on a slightly different issue. I don't have it underlined, that's why I can't, oh, here it is, verse in chapter 15. I won't get into it, but you remember that event, if you're familiar with the passage, where he makes a promise to him about possessing the land, which is a different promise than the one we looked at. I'll talk about that in a little bit later. But there's a different promise that he makes to him, and which is also conditional. It's clearly conditional, but it's non-contingent. And the way the text shows us that it's non-contingent is God puts Abraham to sleep. God says, bring me some pigeons and rams and turtle doves. He brings him a ram and some turtle doves and some pigeons. And then he puts Abraham to, I guess Abraham cuts him in half and laid them opposite each other. And then God puts him to sleep. While Abraham is asleep, God personifies himself in some kind of flaming fire or smoking oven or something like that, and passes back and forth between the animals. It just sounds utterly bizarre to us. But the Bible scholars tell us that that was basically an ancient form of making a contractual arrangement. It's a way, like we sign the contract, one way in which in that culture you made a covenant with someone and made that covenant binding on you was through this ritual that is being described here. Well, God enacted that ritual, but the text makes a point of saying he put Abraham to sleep. And it seems to me that the whole point of that is to say, look, this was an absolutely, completely unilateral agreement on God's part. God is agreeing to this. Abraham's not agreeing to nothing. But God is agreeing that he's going to keep these promises, so he signs the contract. That's the tension that you see here. On the one hand, it's going to happen. God says it's going to happen. God promises it's going to happen, and nothing can stop it. On the other hand, it's only going to happen if Abraham will do what God has asked him to do, has required of him. Okay, what does he promise? I will make you a great nation. I don't think he means it. Well, okay, so what is this great nation that he's talking about? Ultimately, what I would argue, and I don't have time to actually make my case, but what I would argue is that in this particular promise, in this particular passage, the great nation that he has in mind is a whole sea of people who are from every family, tribe, nation, people of the earth throughout all history, who belong to this nation by virtue of the fact that they are children of Abraham, but children of Abraham not in a literal physical sense, but they are children of Abraham in the sense that they reflect the likeness of his heart. They reflect the likeness of his faith. Their character, their disposition, their heart disposition is just like Abraham. And so in a metaphorical sense, they can be described as his children. They resemble him the way a child resembles a parent. They resemble him spiritually, morally, in terms of characterologically. And so, because they are all his children in this sense, a part of his family, we can think of them as being a unified group of people, in other words, a nation. I'm going to make you into a great and mighty nation, a great and mighty sea of people. And ultimately, I would argue that what he has in mind is he's looking down through the whole flow of human history and has in mind people from every nation, every race, every tribe, every language, every whatever, who out of the drama of their own lives come to believe the truths of God and the reality of God and the reality of his promises and the reality of what he's offering in the same way that Abraham did. And God in this promise is saying to Abraham, you're the first person in all of human history. And that's what I was talking about earlier. That's why Abraham is so significant. He's not just a godly person. He's the first person in all of human history, thousands of years ago, that the true, living, transcendent God came to and said, let me explain to you what I'm up to here. What I'm up to is, I intend to bless you. But not just you, you and your whole cotton-picking family. And it's going to be a big family. It's going to be a mighty nation, a great and huge nation, more numerous than the stars of the sky and the sand on the seashore. It's going to be a lot of people that are going to be, in a sense, descended from you, that are going to be your family. And then the next one is, and I will bless you. The thing that you and your whole nation have in store for you is this a blessing that I want to give you. Okay, this is just so frustratingly vague. And that's another question I want to discuss in a second. Would you go to Canaan for a blessing? Can you give me a hint, God? I mean, a nickel, a quarter, a couple $100? What are we talking about here? Is it worth the trip? God is just not specific at this point. He just says, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to do a good thing for you. And I think it helps us to, well, I don't know, we'll come back to that. The way the rest of the Bible treats this, well, especially when you get to the New Testament is absolutely clear in its mind what this blessing consists of. This blessing is what Jesus called eternal life. That is, this blessing is, I'm going to grant to you, Abraham, access into the eternal kingdom of God that's going to be established in the age to come. I'm going to give you life beyond this world, beyond the frustration and the futility of this world, life as it's going to be found in the coming age. So, the promise is I'm going to make you a great nation, and you and that nation I'm going to bless. I'm going to make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. That next phrase is unclear to me. It's ambiguous, and I don't quite know what to do with it. But I think the best I can do is I think they go together. I'm going to make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. That is to say, you, Abraham, are going to be one really significant person in all of human history, because everyone in their own life as an individual is going to have to come to terms with, are they or are they not going to follow your example? You're going to believe me. You're going to take this blessing that I'm promising you seriously. You're going to see it as valuable, and you're going to pursue it. Everyone else that follows is going to have to ask themselves, himself or herself, the question, do I want to do what he did? God came and promised Abraham a blessing and said that he's going to have an offspring who are also going to be blessed. Do I want to be his child? Do I want to be Abraham's child? And so every human throughout all of human history ultimately has to come to terms with Abraham. That makes Abraham a really big deal. And I think that's the sense in which his name is going to be great. God is saying. I will bless you, I will make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. That is in the sense that in terms of how they respond to you, do they reject you as a fool, or do they emulate you as a wise man? What they do with you is going to dictate whether or not they themselves will be a blessing. To the extent that they emulate you, your name, Abraham, is going to prove to be a blessing to them. Something like that, I think, is what he has in mind. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. What is he getting at? I think what he's saying is, the people who bless you, which I take to mean the people who look at your life and what it was all about and what you invested your existence in and say, now there's somebody who knew what he was doing, I would like to do that too. That is, they praise you for the choice that you have made with your life. Those people are going to be blessed. Those people who empathize with you, those people who identify with you, they will get the same blessing that you get. Those people who look at your life and say, what a fool, what an idiot, what an incredibly shallow person who didn't know, didn't have any savvy and didn't know what this life is all about, those are the people who will be cursed rather than blessed. They will miss out on the blessing that you're going to get. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, I think some translations translate that by you, and by you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And that leads many Bible teachers, many Bible interpreters, to see this as a kind of veiled reference to Jesus. That is, or even translating it in you, sometimes people take it this way, that somebody in your line, somebody who is in you, Abraham, is going to be the blessing for all the nations of the earth. That's not the way the apostles interpret this statement. Paul, for example, in Galatians, I'm convinced that when you understand his argument, that the way he's understanding this is by virtue of their being your child, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So he's taking in you, he's understanding in you to be what we might say by being in your family, in you in the sense of belonging to your kin, belonging to your family, belonging to your nation. Insofar as they are in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This is an incredibly cryptic statement, because, you know, translated into a contradiction. Because they're in your family, all the people who are not in your family will be blessed. It's a clear indication that this kind of familial relationship that he's referring to is obviously not literal and not physical. Otherwise, this sentence makes absolutely no sense at all. Otherwise, it's a patent contradiction. But what he's saying is, all these people who are physically descended from somebody else and who don't belong to your family, nonetheless, they are going to receive a blessing insofar as they join themselves to your family, insofar as they become members of your family. These two verses with these promises that are being made, this is really basically the first divine revelation of what later in the New Testament we will come to call the gospel. It's the proclamation of the gospel itself. Here we are, human beings stuck here in a world, in a life, in an existence that is frustrating, it's futile, it's disappointing, it's hollow, because our heart longs for so much more than this life can actually deliver. And the more we go after life to try to wring meaning and significance out of it, the more frustrated we get and hollow it seems. God is coming along into that existence, and he's saying, I'm going to bless you. Somehow, I have to understand, the author of Hebrews points out an interesting fact about Abraham, and that is that Abraham somehow, in a way that the text does not explain, somehow grasped the significance of what God was promising him. It would be so easy to look at this and trivialize what's being promised him. Hey, Abraham, I'll take you into a land, and You can have lots of crops, you'll get rich, have a not half bad life before you die. That might be worth responding to. I mean, if this life is all there is, that would be okay, and there wouldn't be anything wrong with responding to that on those terms. And as a matter of fact, Abraham did prosper material, and he did pretty well for himself, and it even describes him at the end of his life as having lived a long and prosperous life because he had been blessed by God. That's true. But the author of Hebrews in the New Testament points out some really striking features of Abraham's life. And that is, Abraham kept passing up the good things of this life. One classic example of that, of course, is the time that he comes back from Egypt and he returns to the place in southern Canaan where he had first come after he left Haran. And evidently Lot, his nephew, had been left behind there, and Lot had settled in and was grazing the pasture land there. Abraham comes back with a whole lot more cattle than he had when he left. And it happens to be the case that there's just not enough grazing land for the two of them, for all of Abraham's herds and Lot's herds. They recognize the problem, and they get together and they say, look, we're going to have to go off in different directions and graze different land because this just isn't going to work. And so Abraham says, so tell you what, Lot, you pick where you want to go, and I'll go the other direction. And the choice was the the valley, the valley of something at the time, but it's where Sodom, Gomorrah, and the cities of the valley, I think they call them, was today, I wouldn't choose it, but the way they describe it here, there's evidently been a tremendous climate change, because the way they describe it there, it was just incredibly lush land. Lot takes a look at that. He takes a look at the rather sparse hill country, says, I'll take the valley. Abraham says, cool. You go there, I'll go into the hills. Immediately following that, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward, for all the land which you see I will give to you and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your seed can also be numbered. Arise, walk around about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Now, elsewhere in the Genesis account, he describes giving the land to Abraham. In those other accounts, it's a little bit different, because he says, he gives very definite boundaries to it. Chapter 15, verse 18, on the day that the Lord made a covenant, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your seed I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite. Which I take to be very definite areas that he says the people, the land that is inhabited by that group of people, that's your land. That's the land that I'm giving to you. Now, I haven't talked about this yet. There are two promises that God makes to Abraham. One, the one I've been talking about, pertains to his, we might call it spiritual seed, this spiritual nation who are spiritually descended from Abraham because they resemble him in heart and character. He also makes a promise to Abraham's physical descendants. The one I just read, I think, is a promise that's being made to Abraham's physical descendants. And he's giving them a very specific land that is theirs and that belongs to them in perpetuity, and an everlasting covenant, an everlasting right to the land, which drives the peace talks crazy. And here in this particular passage, he's given the paradise land to Lot. And in response to that, I think very interestingly, God comes to him, takes him to the mountain, and he doesn't give him any specific boundaries or parameters to this land. He says, look east, look north, look south, whatever's left, west. As far as your eye can see, it's all yours. Now, we could take that literally, and he only got the land to the horizon. I think what he's trying to say is, Abraham, because you were willing to give up the goodies of this world, because you are willing to pass over the best things that this world has to offer, your reward is going to be, I'm going to give you the whole world. The whole world is going to be yours. One of the reasons I say that is because the New Testament authors explicitly make that claim that Abraham became an heir to the whole world. And Jesus makes the claim, the meek shall inherit the world. That's an important New Testament theme. I don't know where they're getting it from the Old Testament if they're not getting it from here. And it seems a very plausible way to read that passage because its conjunction with Abraham's willingness, his meekness, you have his meekness going, look, I don't deserve nothing. Whatever you think you want, Lot, you take that. I'll take whatever's left. That's fine with me. His meekness God rewarded with the inheritance of the whole world. Now, what does he mean by the whole world? Obviously, when you get to the New Testament, it's actually not the world that he saw that he's going to inherit. What he was going to inherit was that world recreated and made into a new world, a new heavens and a new earth. It's the world to come that he would inherit, not the world that was. The author of Hebrews suggests that somehow, to some extent, Abraham understood that. Because the way the author of Hebrews puts it, Abraham remained a sojourner. Let's read that. He remained a sojourner in the land. God had promised him the land, and he chose not to live in the land that God had given to him. And why? Because he was looking for a better country, a heavenly country, a heavenly city. That's the way that Hebrews puts it. All these died in faith, and the these he's talking about are all of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac after him, and Jacob after him. All these died in faith without receiving the promises. They didn't see the realization of the promises that God had made to them. But having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, that is Ur, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. The thing that's striking to me about that is the fact that Abraham, as the New Testament authors see it at least, grasped the significance of what God was saying to him. He didn't minimize or trivialize or, secularize this promise to him. He didn't see this promise as just a promise of riches, of prosperity, of worldly success. Because that's not what he was, something that matched that emptiness and longing in his heart. Something that went beyond the superficial stuff of this world and this life and actually met that deep, deep, deep longing that was within him. And somehow, Abraham knew that what this God was offering him was that. Even so much so that even after he took him to Canaan, he didn't think that Canaan was it. He didn't think that that was really the fulfillment of the promise of what God was giving him. And he was looking for that country that would be his own, that heavenly country. And therefore, that's the reward that he's going to get. The other thing that's striking is the perseverance of Abraham's faith. God made him this promise some point fairly early in his life. To the end of his days, you know, decades later, he's still believing in this promise, not having seen any of it come true. And he's exactly in the same situation that we're in. We're going to go to our grave, not seeing anything of what the gospel promises us come true in our life. And obviously it can't, because what God has promised us is for something beyond this life. But that's the challenge, that's the struggle of faith, is to go on believing that the God who spoke is a good God who has my best interest in mind and is making a promise to me that I don't understand, I have not experienced it, I'm flying blind here in a way. What has the gospel promised me? Eternal life. What's eternal life? Life beyond. Can I ask a question? Is that going to be good or bad? life beyond. I mean, can you be a little bit more specific? If I'm going to put my hope in it, if I'm going to abandon, if I'm going to curb my passions for the things of this world and this life for the sake of that invisible, abstract thing out there way beyond, could you give me some clue as to whether it's going to be worth it? Somehow, we just have to know that it's worth it. And how do we know? How do we just know? Ultimately, it comes down to, who is the God speaking to me? Is he a God who would call a blessing something that is not, that does not measure up to the longing of my heart? Or is he a God who would shine me on? Is he a God who would trifle with me? And that's ultimately the existential question, the theological question, really, that all of us face in our lifetime, is exactly the same one that Abraham did as he stood there at Ur, being talked to by this God who had never spoken to him before, saying, look, go to this land that I will show you and I will bless you. It's exactly the position that we're in. God has, in one way or the other, however he's confronted us, he has confronted us and he said, I'm the author of all existence. I'm the one and only true God of the universe. I'm here to tell you that this life is not what it's all about. I have another kingdom awaiting beyond this age, and that's going to be worth it, and that's going to satisfy the longing of your heart. So do as I say, and that will be yours. And the question is the same question that Abraham faced. What am I going to do with that? I can't see it. I can't experience it. I don't know firsthand whether that's going to be worth it. I have to judge on the merits of who this God is that's speaking to me. I was going to get into the epistemological questions involved in that, but I ran out of time, much to your delight. So I guess I'll leave it at that unless you have questions. Those of you who have to go, feel free.
Since the time of Abraham,
right. There's
been a whole history of revelation. So it seems to me that we're in a different position than we're
in. Yes, I think we are. For example, the fact that I could say, what is this blessing? This blessing is eternal life, is something more specific than Abraham was apparently given. But the point I'm making is not that we don't have more information and don't have more specific information, because I think clearly we do. But even with that more specific information, it doesn't remove the distance between me and my knowledge and what it is that I'm putting my faith in and my hope in. There's still a gap there that can only be bridged by my confidence in the character of the God making the promise.
Right.
That was my point.
It seems like if you were to look at textual evidence, archaeological evidence, historical evidence, not that all leads to an improved understanding of the character of God.
Confirmation that this is for real. Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's not as if we don't have things to look at in history that confirm that God really is up to what he said he was up to. That's a good point.
Do you think that Abram had a previous knowledge of God before he first?
Well, that's one of the things I would have raised, is did God have to somehow train him to hear his voice and know who he was and know his identity? I think that's one possibility. Just because the text itself does not tell us that that's the case doesn't mean it was not the case. The other possibility is that somehow God occurred to him in such a way that his appearance, his manifestation to Abraham, was somehow self-authenticating. And it seems to me that's not outside the realm of possibility either. I think that's possible. The one thing that I would want to hold out for is that however it is that Abraham decided this God was different and deserved to be listened to, it was because he had reasons for that. It's because he had evidence. Articulating the nature of that evidence, I don't even know if Abraham necessarily could have done that. But just because we can't articulate the reasons why we believe something doesn't mean that we don't have reasons. It doesn't mean that it's not a rational thing. Did that? Logan?
That's something I've always wondered about. It says God led Abraham from Ur of Chaldees. Is it possible, and it sounds like you're saying it is, that circumstantially Abraham was moved from one place to another, but we're looking at it in retrospect? Abraham may not have been aware that he was being moved, right? I mean, he could have relocated for any one of a dozen reasons, and then in retrospect realized, oh, that was when God started working in my life.
Yeah,
that's when he started putting me places. I didn't know it. Mm-hmm. I mean, from famine, plague, politics, in-laws, whatever. We do that in our own lives. That obviously happened because of something God did in my life. But at the time, we were completely clueless of what was going on.
The issue here is whether or not this particular part of the promise that God is making to Abraham is conditional. Because if this part of it is conditional, then his going forth is the obedience that's going to be rewarded with this other. And if he's going because there's a famine, that's pretty cheap obedience. If he's forced out, then I'm not sure that's meeting the condition of obedience which is being rewarded. But I would grant you that this particular part of the promises that God makes to Abraham, they come in bits and pieces throughout his life, and we didn't have time to get into all of them. But this particular part of the promise may not have a condition attached to it. So that's possible.
So the announcements that God, you're reading it as the announcements God is making, they're not subsequent to that mentioning that Abraham came up from Ur of the Chaldees, but rather their reiteration of what was happening in his coming up from Ur of the Chaldees. Did God bring Abram up and then make these promises? God, brought Abram up, and then now let me tell you let me give you that story again, only with a deeper, and now another.
Well, part of the, if I'm following you, part of the problem is, if we just had this account to go on, it sounds like he goes up to Haran, and then God speaks to him. And then he leaves and goes to Canaan. Every other account of this text states it that God called him out of Ur, and that he went to Haran, and then he went to Canaan. That Stephen's speech in Acts has it explicitly stated that way, and I don't remember where it is, but a little bit later here in the Genesis account where it recounts that, it talks about him being called out of Ur by God. So they seem to be this text does suggest it when you include chapter 11, because it says his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. You see what I'm saying? That is, on their way to Canaan, they went to Haran. Well, they were headed to Canaan. They were headed out in response, in obedience to this thing. So it's just that in the account itself, it tells you that's what they did, and then it tells you why they did it, because God had appeared to him in Ur and said this thing to him. Does that help?
It just seems like from the get-go, Abram was such a stranger in his own land.
Yeah.
Who is this guy?
Yeah.
It's curious that Abraham doesn't know when to stop.
What do you mean?
Well, he goes to a place called Shechem, creates an altar there, mm-hmm. and then after that he goes to a place called the Oak of Moriah.
Yeah.
Makes an altar there. He goes to the Negev. Mm-hmm. hangs around there until a famine occurs, and he
goes to Egypt.
It's kind of like, well, God says, go until I tell you to stop.
Well, I think the reason that he's called a sojourner in Hebrews is I think he was a nomad. I think he lived a kind of a Bedouin nomadic lifestyle. He had his crops and he just kept moving. I don't. It's not like us moving, you know, from location to location. It's just a question of where he's staking his tents and grazing his herds. I think. Which is part of the point of the letter of the Hebrews is, if God gave you the land, sink a foundation and build a palace, for goodness sakes. It's yours. It's yours for keeps. It's yours to stay there. But he didn't opt to do that. He opted to just stay the Bedouin, to just graze over the surface of it. And their point is, because it's not really that land he wanted. That wasn't really what it was all about for him. He wanted his own country that is a heavenly one. Which I just really... is striking to me. Tucker?
It seems to me that it is important that the promises made to Abraham are vague and that we understand that they were vague and that we have more information. But yet, at the same time, when we're talking about what is this age to come? What is this heavenly kingdom? What is this kingdom of God that we're waiting for? That we're still going on the word of the Apostle Paul and the word of Jesus. And that unless there's something happening in my life that opens my eyes to see what this world really offers, and puts a longing in my heart for something like that, that amount of information won't mean any, doesn't really add up to any more than what Abraham had. It's still just as foolish and ludicrous. I can't, if I try to put myself into the place of a person who isn't longing for that, who isn't looking for that, who doesn't
understand such a longing.
Yeah. I can't imagine a more stupid person than someone who believes in those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me that Abraham's longing and these vague promises, that it isn't really a question of information. In the checkpoint, we talked about how, that there's sometimes this idea among Christians that if they can just completely destroy the theory of evolution and convince somebody that their belief in that theory is utterly wrong, that the next step for that person would be then to just walk over to the Christian camp and become a Christian. That's not what happens. I mean, rarely does anything like that happen. And if that does happen, that person that makes that step over to become a Christian would probably later look back on their life and say, while I was a staunch evolutionist, there was some real longing in my heart for years that I never could put a finger on. But
I think that's very important, what you're saying, Tucker. That the thing that came to mind as I was looking at Abraham here is there's that scene where Thomas has been the only disciple who was not in the room when Jesus appeared to them, and all the other disciples had been there and had seen Jesus and known that he was raised from the dead. And they report it to Thomas, and Thomas says, no way. Unless I put my fingers in the holes in the side in his hands, I can't believe what you're saying. And so the next time Jesus appears, Thomas is there, and Jesus invites him to put his fingers in his sides and the prints in his side in his hands. And remember what Jesus says. He says, Thomas, do you believe because you have seen me? Do you now believe? Blessed are those who believe though they have not seen me. And typically people take that as some kind of rebuke or criticism of Thomas, but I really don't think Jesus meant it that way. you know, he's gone down in history as Doubting Thomas, which is one of the biggest misnomers that has ever occurred in history, because Thomas' doubt was not any greater than the doubt of any of the other disciples. There wasn't a single one of them, with the possible exception of a little bit of a hint of a belief in John, there wasn't a single one of the disciples who believed without seeing. And so we can't very well criticize Thomas for something that was true of every last one of the disciples. He's just asking for the same evidence that all of them had before he will believe. And yet, Jesus says, but the day is coming when people are going to be called upon to believe and they don't get a chance to see. And he says, they're blessed. And I think what he means by that is, it's really a gift from God. It is genuinely a blessing from God that any of us will have the wherewithal to get over the intellectual hurdle of not ourselves being eyewitnesses to these things. Because it's just so easy to dismiss it as, well, I wasn't there, I just don't believe what those guys said. I don't think it really happened. It's just implausible to me. I can't accept it. How is it that you and I get over that intellectual hurdle and believe it anyway? I think it's exactly what you were saying. The reason is because, ultimately, what the gospel is promising resonates so strongly with what I know my own heart wants and needs that the reports of all those eyewitnesses begin to make sense to me. Granted, I wasn't there, and yes, they may be making this up, they may be lying, but this is such an incredible message as compared to what my heart longs for and what I need, what I want out of my existence, that this has to be true. I really think it must have happened. It really makes sense to me. And that, of course, having that longing and seeing my life in that way is something that the Spirit of God does in my life. It supernaturally produces the kind of sensitivity and being hip to reality enough to recognize my own need.
It's that demanding of that physical evidence, in a sense, is one of the aspects that makes the apostles the apostles. Because that's why later they can write,
I was there.
I was there. I heard him speak. I saw him. You know, and it lends credence to their position. And it's one of the distinctions between me and the apostles.
Exactly.
Can you flesh out that the concept of meekness a little bit more? It's a vague term for me, and I don't really understand it. And specifically, I'm referring to Abraham. And I understand the distinction that the life to come was so much more important than anything that it had to offer here on earth. But if I was faced with the same decision with Lot, I would have said, let's flip coins. and I don't think it's because I place any less value on the life to come, but it's just, I don't know. Maybe it is, but I don't think so. I just think that... And I guess all business decisions, it seems like now, are kind of based that way. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're making decisions, it's not that you're thinking this is more important than life to come, but you are still in the present making decisions on things here.
Yeah, I second that.
Yeah, but how many of those are moral decisions?
Well, in this circumstance, lots, that didn't seem like a moral decision. It was, they were both crowded, you know, they needed a solution. I would have assumed that if Abraham flipped the coin and if he had done that and lost, he would have been just as meek and he wouldn't have had any problem with it, because he would have known that, you know, his life is in God's hand and so be it. His, you know, he's invested in the future.
Yeah, but they're in a different space. I mean, there's significance attached to their persons, their history, their descendants, and that land. If you're arguing with your brother who's going to take a certain... I'm going to take the Northwest Territory for sales, or Dead Rabbit. There's no one that lives out in the East. I don't want to do the East. Well, we can't both have the same territory. But, you know, okay, we'll flip a coin. See, you got to make that decision, because that's just business. But there's nothing attached to that land, to that territory for you, other than money. With Abraham, there was the promises of God. I mean, there's a lot more going on than just business for him.
Maybe they didn't have any coins.
If they tossed Philistines in
them. Abraham saw when he, God said that he would bless them. Mm-hmm. And Abraham understood that. Not he maybe understood a broader blessing in heaven, but also understood it in terms of God's going to take care of me here and now. And God did. I mean, God multiplied his cattle and he understood it in terms of my life here is going to be okay too. In a sense, when he said, Lot, you can take that, I mean, if he understood God, understood that God is going to take care of me, it's really a matter of faith in that he said, it doesn't matter, Lot, you can take either one because God's promised me that he's going to bless me. So I can go up in the hills, I can go down in the grasslands, it doesn't matter, God's going to take care of me. So in a way, I mean, that is his manifesting his faith in God, I mean, that he would do that. It didn't mean Lot could take it because he wasn't worried. I mean, and I just wonder if that's kind of more the significance of why, I mean, why he could just let it go because he was confident that God was going to bless him. I mean, I don't know how that. I mean, you're taking the blessing as broader, and maybe he saw that too. But the fact is that he did. I mean, his cattle and his lands and everything increased. I mean, yeah. He was a mm-hmm. He was blessed with material things as well as.
I get the question or the problem I have with that is just what exactly is the scope of the promise? Because in Abraham's case, it ended up being true that he was blessed materially as well as spiritually, but that has not always been the case. It wasn't the case with Jesus, for example.
But he was also given, I mean, in a sense, Abraham, I mean, the Jews were also, I mean, as well as the broader blessing, they were given a blessing of, you're going to have this land. I mean,
yeah.
So.
Well, they were promised material prosperity even, but that's a different promise. And I'm hesitant to read that promise into this one. You may be right. And it may be, you may be right that that's what God meant, and you may be right that that's how Abraham understood it. But I'm hesitant there because I think he's just talking about something different that doesn't have any implications one way or the other about whether he would prosper materially. So I'd have to think about that. But even if it were the case, I'm not sure it still solves Paul's problem because, yeah, he's trusting God to take care of him, and how is he doing that? By giving me the flip of the coin that gives me the valley, or right? I mean, don't you still have that question, that problem?
I think what the issue seems to be is not so much that I'll take whatever the circumstances are, it's that there's a difference between giving Lot the choice and then having us both agree that however the coin ends up, that's how we're going to go. Because it seems like, I mean, from the looks of things, that one land certainly appears better than the other one, or something like that. And that Abraham really ultimately does not know which one is going to be if he went to either one, it would have been the one that would have worked out. But the thing about the flip of the coin is that at least that, I mean, it would seem to me that gives me some chance. I mean, that if we can just both agree that however the coin ends up, then there's still a possibility that this can end up the way I want it. Whereas the giving of it over to Lot demonstrates Abraham's total dependence or concession to whatever is going to happen. I mean, even to the point where, you know, I mean, I'm just going to give Lot the choice. I'm going to let him decide where it's going to go. I'm not going to have us both agree to, you know, agree on the possibility that it might still work out my way. It's guaranteed it might not work out the way this way, but I'd be okay with that. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be the difference between any kind of flip of coin or anything like
right.
that. And that's probably, I think, what you were trying to get at with regard to. That is the demonstration of Abraham's total reliance and total acceptance of whatever happens, even if all the possibilities that seem to have been taken out of the situation, you know, it's so decided that Lot is going to pick the better land.
Roger, you want to weigh in?
There's also a sociological reason why flipping a coin wouldn't be desirable, because, as I understand it, Abraham wouldn't have given up his authority as the patriarch of the family. By letting Lot make the choice, he's still retaining the authority of the family. I'm the one giving you the choice to go left or right.
Like it's his to give.
If he leaves it up to a flip of a coin, then he's saying, I'm really relinquishing my authority as the patriarch of the family, and we're just going to kind of leave it.
I hadn't thought about that. Mm.
The other thing is, it's not altogether...
Of course, it also accentuates the meekness of what he did. Because as the patriarch, he had the authority to say, I'm going there, you're going there.
I think it would be important to keep in mind that it probably wasn't the retaining the patriarchal position probably wasn't a power trip thing, but was a responsibility.
Right. I take that. Because earlier, Lot is his nephew. His brother
had died.
And I kind of get the idea that Abraham took Lot under his...
Right.
Protection. And kind of the other thing I was going to say is a verse that's either before or after that says that land was the land of the Sodomites,
right?
And that the Sodomites were known to be
exceedingly wicked or evil. They were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord.
And we find out later that
it was party town.
The king of Sodom actually claimed Lot as a subject of his. So to be in the land, you get the benefit of having the good soil, but you have to be under the king, under the subjugation of an evil king. So yeah, there are pluses and minuses.
Yeah, and it's hard to know how much that weighed in their decision. I've gone back and forth. How much of that is just commentary of the text about the significance of the choice, and how much of that was really fully known by them and was being considered as they made the choice. It's hard to tell. To answer your question directly, I would define meekness as not taking the attitude that I have a right to what I want, essentially. That's meekness. Or to put it another way, to not take the attitude that I deserve something. The opposite of meekness is entitlement, is an attitude of entitlement of some kind. That this is hard and controversial, and I know that there's all kinds of people that climb up one side of me and down the other for me saying this, but it seems to me that business runs on the principle of the opposite of meekness, as does much of our life. I mean, especially when you look at, you know, rules of negotiating and that kind of stuff, they're all predicated on the assumption that my goal is to get the most that I can get out of this thing, out of this negotiation. That's exactly the opposite attitude that Abraham is taking here. He's just simply taking the attitude that, okay, I don't get as much out of this world, this situation, the circumstances I might find desirable. You don't always get what you want. It doesn't work out that way. Both of us can't have it. I should probably prefer that he get it and not me. It's Paul's attitude that, think of others more highly than yourself in Philippians 2. That's the attitude of meekness, that if there's limited possibilities for good things in this world and it's between me and somebody else, it ought to be the somebody else. That's meekness.
So even in today's standards, with, you know, aside from the family issues or the promises or something like that, you still think that type of attitude is exemplified by Abraham would be the appropriate one when we're faced with those types of decisions, either in a business context or something else?
Yeah. Now, see, you can always take a principle like that and run to absurd extremes with it. The choice for Abraham was not feast or famine. You know, he wasn't choosing famine. What he got was okay. You know, it was good. It was fine. It was adequate. It was wonderful. He prospered where he was, but he could have had better, at least from the standpoint of what do you call it, fodder for his whatever it is. He could have had what appeared on the surface at least to be better. So it wasn't a question of am I jeopardizing my household by making this choice, but rather am I getting the most I can get? And it's that kind of greed, that kind of that grasping attitude that if there's a good out there in the world, I got to have it. I better have it. That's what's the opposite of meekness. But, you know, common sense tells you to provide for my family, to take care of myself, to feed myself, and so on. I shouldn't be stupid. You know, I should take whatever reasonable means I can to do whatever I need to do. But there comes a point where you cross over the line and you're not just taking care of yourself, you're out to get whatever you can get. And then it's become a moral and spiritual issue. It's not me just being commonsensical here and being prudent. It's no longer being prudent. I'm being grasping and greedy. And particularly it's ultimately what we're talking about is that root of heart attitude, that heart attitude of entitlement. God owes me. Life owes me. Somebody owes me. I don't care who. I just am owed. Yeah.
Flipping a coin, to me, isn't grasping. But so what you're saying is, though, you don't even get to that. You're one step behind it.
Yeah, because you're, as Paul puts it in Philippians, we outdo one another in showing kindness. How does he put it? We outdo one another in showing preference to one another. That's a virtue to be so eager to let other people have and thus us to go without. It's big. We're talking something that doesn't come naturally.
Well, yeah, and I see it more in a group of believers or something as opposed to a business context.
Yeah. Well, business. Compare the CEO of Ben & Jerry's with the CEO of Scott Paper Company.
But yeah, but still even the CEO of Ben & Jerry's, my guess is, isn't giving other people the choice of which area they want to have their ice cream in. He's going at it just as
hard
as
anybody else. There was that other CEO who...
I'm lost with your example.
Ben & Jerry's is notorious for being an employee-friendly, trying to do everything they can to be environmentally friendly, programs that help assist employees, having a fun hour every day, just, you know, jokes going right and left. I guess it's just a great place to work.
Apparently. But I don't know, the current CEO of Scott Paper Company, but there was a guy they hired. He came in, gutted the whole place, fired a bunch of people, and it looked really good on the bottom line. All just their stock went up, everybody won. Well, not everybody. The stockholders won, everybody else lost. I mean, you have that cut and run kind of deal where that's not the kind of meekness I don't think you're talking about.
Right.
I was just thinking, too, the land that looked the best was also where people had settled and were evil. And, I mean, you could draw parallels in the business world to that, is that if you're going to go the way that most people are going who've been successful, they probably got there by, you know, making the choice that they thought was their right. I don't know. It seems to me that evil, the fact that, I mean, he saw that it was well-watered and everything, but also other people had seen it, people who maybe were not whom he would like to emulate or maybe he couldn't resist. I mean, it's kind of hard to tell how much he resisted them and how much he didn't. I mean, he sent out his daughters instead of, you know. But, I mean, that wasn't the place for him to go. But evidently, I mean, it would have been better if he could have avoided that environment. But it looked good.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful, though, and not make an analogy between going into wickedness and success at business, because there's all kinds of things that can produce success at business, hard work, industry, creativity, that are perfectly valid and perfectly legitimate.
I haven't even thought of it except for this question, but I was thinking that a lot of people go in a certain direction because it's efficacious, you know, and you see those results, and that's you know. And that's what Lot did. He thought it looked good, but a lot of other people thought it looked good, and they weren't always the...
Yeah.
They weren't the...
Well, that's exactly right. That's certainly true, that just because something in worldly terms will bring prosperity doesn't make it the right choice. That, exactly. It can be very much the wrong choice. I wish I could help you, Paul, in a business context, but yeah, it's just not my world, and I haven't had enough experience. It's got to be hard. It's got to be incredibly hard to take the kinds of character traits that are required of us as Christians into that kind of environment. Politics would be another one. Business, politics. Is there anything else?
Football.
Yeah. Those have got to be really, really difficult environments to operate on in these principles. And it would be a constant struggle, I should think.
Even relationships. I mean, you know, if you're not getting what you want in a marriage, you know, what do you do? Of course, I mean, everybody else out there, I mean, it's sort of the same thing. You go, I just said, what glitters, you know, is not always gold, but...
Yeah, so that's a good point. Exactly. Relationships is a huge one that we all face. Tucker?
You know, I'm not really sure... exactly what I think about this, or if I'm even heading in the right direction with this, but there seems to me, as I've been just kind of thinking about it, that there may in fact be something fundamentally different between one's attitude in general about flipping a coin over a decision versus one's attitude of meekness towards an attitude. In a sense, to me, that the idea of just sort of giving in to fate, you know, or being willing to say, well, whatever the decision is, you know, that's fine. There could be a certain amount of meekness. I mean, one, I suppose, could have an attitude of meekness in that. But I'm trying to think of, why do we normally want to flip coins? Why do people normally want to flip coins in making a decision? And it seems to me that my understanding of the biblical perspective on meekness is not the same attitude. That meekness is something that is, it's actually about desires that we have that are different than if we were not meek. It's actually about making choices and being sort of impelled, desiring to go in a certain direction than if we were not meek. And in a sense, we flip coins precisely because we don't want to have to make the meek decision. We want it to be made for us. We want there to be a context in which that decision is taken out of our hands. We say, well, let's just flip a coin. Let's just see, you know, and then we'll just go with that. Mm-hmm. And then there's no opportunity really for feelings to be involved, or if there are, then... And we say, well, you know, you shouldn't have those feelings. Remember, it's a coin. You called heads and it came up tails. You know, that kind of thing. Where, I guess I just kind of feel like Abraham, in that context, if he truly was working out of a meek heart, flipping a coin wouldn't be adequate for him. He wasn't standing there with this. I think partly because when we kind of step back from it, we're looking at, we're thinking of meekness as being a choice. Like, well, am I going to be meek right now or not? Well, in a sense, yeah, that's true. But in another even deeper sense, I think at times, and maybe with Abraham here, although we're not given a lot of evidence in terms of description of his attitudes, he may have just been acting out of something that was driving him, something that was really intent on not just who gets the land, who gets to go where, but on really loving Lot and on really trusting God and really being in a position of responsibility and saying, I really want you to be the one that makes this decision.
Yeah. Or another way of saying, I think, what is the same thing, is that he's well practiced at not being ruled by his desires. not allowing his desires to have such a force in his life that they can't be thwarted, or that it would be a real bummer to have them thwarted. He can have it or not.
And I think what I'm kind of getting at is, although I don't think flipping a coin is a bad thing, and it's certainly one's response to the outcome of that says a lot about one's, who one is.
You mean like, can we do 2 out of 3?
Yeah. What's really interesting about a situation like that is that you could do 2 out of 3, or 3 out of 5, or 5 out of 7, you know, and still eventually have a cut off the line and say, okay, and then go with whatever the decision is. And that would be a good thing, to go with whatever that decision is. That's kind of like the way in our culture here, there's a vote on a particular issue, and you may be on the side that loses because this is a democracy and you have these higher ideals or something, you kind of go with the majority. You do maybe whatever you can to change it, but you're not just totally bent out of shape. Generally, what you are, just say, that's the way this country works. There's systems that we can, you know, next time around, maybe we can change it. And with flipping a coin, we can say, well, that's the way it goes. Next time, maybe it will go in my favor when we flip the coin.
There are 2 other reasons we might flip a coin, though. For example, in Acts, they draw lots, flip a coin, to choose the next apostle. You know, why are these guys not just saying to one another, oh, no, you be the apostle, not, I don't want to be the apostle. The reason they're not doing that is because it's really not theirs to give away. I mean, they're seeing that as we're here trying to determine the will of God,
But don't you think that, I mean, I haven't studied that account really, but it just seems to me that they flip a coin, they choose the next apostle, you never hear about that guy again,
yeah.
And then God comes along and chooses the next apostle.
Yeah, I thought about that. I don't think that's right. I used to think that was right, but as I studied it recently, I'm not sure that's right.